Hello all and welcome to IT Origins, a weekly interview series from Gestalt IT. Each time we meet, we talk to entrepreneurs, engineers, and innovators in the space of IT and find out how they got their start. Today, we have the privilege to be talking to Tom Green, who I've gotten to know through the Tech Field Day community, and I'm excited to learn more about his IT Origins story. So, Tom, are you ready to get going?
Sure am. Thanks for having me, Rich.
Absolutely. So let's get it started to get the big question out of the way. Tom, what exactly is your IT origin story, and how long have you been in the field?
I've been in IT for about 12 years, to answer your second question first. I started out as a bookkeeper at a real estate office. Actually, I went to small liberal arts college in Kentucky and have an economics degree. So I don't have any sort of education or formal background before work experience in IT. So I was cutting escrow checks and helping pay realtors commissions when I was asked to help enter web keys into the different real estate agents' computers when they came in. It was a small IT firm that was manning it, and they didn't have enough capacity to enter in the same web key 200 times whenever a realtor would get a new computer or a new realtor would come through. I was sitting there anyway. They were always talking to me, so I entered the password for them. And that's how I got started in IT. Whenever there was an opening in that team, they came to me and said, "Everybody knows you. You know how to touch a keyboard and not make a computer explode. Will you join the IT team as a desktop support guy?"
That's a very important qualification to get started in IT.
Yeah, the fewer exploding computers, the better. Unfortunately, throughout my career, I can't say the same for printers. If you ever want a printer fixed, never come to me.
I think if you ever want a printer fixed, you're entering into a world of hurt already. And so, yeah, it's a fool's errand, one way or the other. And so, around what year would that have been? I know I could do the math based on your first answer, but, I'm lazy.
Yeah. 2005, I was a bookkeeper. By the end of 2006, I was a desktop admin.
And then, how did you kind of, move through your career, since then?
Through books. I'm self-taught. So I started just working with Windows XP, and that got boring after about a year. My manager at the time was looking at a server refresh, so he handed me a copy of Mastering vSphere 3.5 and said, "Read this and tell me if this is what we should do." As a desktop admin, my head hurt. I cried when I was learning about virtualization for the first time. And I've been working with servers and virtualization ever since, basically. So yeah, that was a long time ago.
So based on that, it's a very interesting time to be getting into IT, kind of the boom times or the start of the boom times for kind of virtualization and that kind of coming into the industry. So with that kind of perspective, what's been the biggest change in IT since you've started your career?
The biggest change has really been from a service providing industry. So whenever I was coming in, it was racking and stacking physical pizza boxes, and each pizza box had very little performance and ran one application or two if you were trying to conserve money. And now, as I've grown through between server admin, IT architecture, I'm seeing a lot more as a service. I can run a website statically out of a bucket that's some sort of ephemeral thing I don't even care about. It's just my website's up and my files are there. So just seeing IT as a service is easily the biggest thing that's changed for the better, I think.
And so kind of on the other side of that, what do you see right now as kind of the worst trend in IT?
Lift and shift. I love the service model. I love being able to use it, but whenever you're dealing with the, not necessarily changing of the guard, but the evolution of people's skills and understanding of this brave new world, just taking a application that runs in your VMware, Hyper-V, or whatever cluster, and uploading it to AWS doesn't solve your problems. And it's a constant discussion I find myself in of people thinking that it will.
Well, so that's what's always interesting to me is, I mean, maybe I come from it because the people that I'm hearing from are mostly on the, you know, IT admin side. But I've never heard anyone that said, you know, lift and shift, never a problem, always works great. But obviously there's this persistent kind of wish that it would work enough that, you know, we kind of hear constantly on the IT side that it's a terrible idea.
Yeah, it would be great if it would just, you could take a virtual machine from your environment and run it cost effectively with high availability, and it just kind of work how you want it to. The agility and the different architectures of every public cloud service I know of out there doesn't lend itself to that. I know VMware on AWS and some of these other stacks like that are working toward that. There's a real cost barrier that running an AWS instance doesn't have. So I think that could be an interesting trend to watch to see if people are going to start accommodating the legacy type applications.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the one company I've seen really try and hang their hat on that, or at least try and market it that way, is maybe like Oracle, what they're doing with Revelo. And that acquisition, I don't know how well that works in practice. I know that's their big claim, is that, you know, you can, that enables lift and shift. Of course, asterisk, you must use, you know, Oracle's cloud. So very interesting. On the other side of that, what would you say is the best trend in IT? Would that go back to kind of the servicification of IT?
Yeah, my starts were in small business, and I kind of, my heart is always thinking about the small IT admin who's desktop support and trying to clean up the toner from an exploded printer and learning about virtualization and just trying to make the best out of shoestrings. And so I always think about them, and the service or the as a service really kind of helps, even if you're looking at Office 365 or G Suite. Getting out of the Exchange business saves so much time from a small shop perspective. And it's really very affordable. So I think that's the best thing that's helped, you know, small business, and that translates into enterprise as well. But my heart's always going to go out for the small IT shops.
Well, I always think those are the most interesting because they have such a different set of concerns, aka cost is usually one of the top two concerns on any major project. I always find that companies have to get very creative when they're designing solutions, whether they're services or hardware offerings or something like that for SMBs, that you don't, there's a hunger there that you don't get necessarily when you're dealing with something designed for service providers or Fortune 500 or something like that, that I think lends itself personally to being very interesting to me as well.
Yes. I was an architect and did implementation for a company that was a VAR to small, medium business. Mm-hmm. So that was always, you never knew what you were going to find or work with. And it was always interesting to see what people were willing to sacrifice to save, you know, a quarter of the cost. Stuff in the enterprise, you never imagine a high availability being something that can be a good to have, not a necessity.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, it just the very structure of, you know, most of these conversations that you have, you know, when it comes to cost, that's like the ninth conversation that you have, right? It's never like, here's what it costs first, you know, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now I'm serving, you know, bigger enterprises, and it's always interesting because it's in the back of my mind just thinking about, well, how would this go, or how would I get around this too if I weren't, you know, designing 15, 16 node, you know, availability clusters or whatever.
All right. So pulling back a little bit, I'm interested, Tom, how do you approach an organization at work? You know, do you have a particular methodology? Is it haphazard?
Well, it depends on the day. I have a preferred method of organization, and then there's kind of the reality of work. Whenever you're doing sales, pre-sales architecture, there's not always time to do everything I'd like. I like using, typically it's Evernote is what I use to capture a lot of the important things, so I just don't have to remember them myself. And Todoist for to-do lists for the same reason. I think that those two tools are among the best of the free productivity tools you can get. I try to adhere to the getting things done system. It may not work for everybody, but it works for me most of the time, and that's pretty good.
Yeah, Todoist for me meets that needs to have the lowest barrier of entry to inputting what I need to do on there, because there's nothing I can stand worse than having to fill out checkboxes and remind myself and that kind of stuff, and it just kind of gets that.
Yeah, I have it on my Echo, so I can just hear what's coming up next just by yelling at her. Typically, if I've gotten to where I have to do voice commands to listen to or to hear what's coming up next, I'm in a yelling mood anyway, so that's kind of nice.
That kind of opens up a question. What's your ideal workspace like? Do you like some people like being alone, to get some stuff done. Others thrive, in kind of an open workspace. How do you like it, Tom?
I like working. I mean, I work at a home office now. I'm alone, and I like that the best. It gives me the freedom to talk out loud and work out things without disturbing my neighbors or appearing like a lunatic. The pacing around talking to myself, trying to solution out a problem is troubling when people see it, but it's great whenever I can do it in privacy of my own home.
And do you have any, I'm always interested by people that work at home. Do you have any rituals to kind of still maintain some kind of distance between work and home?
Unfortunately, not as much as I would like. It's whenever I'm in my office, the doors are closed and home stays out of work. But with the awesome serviceification of Slack and email, I'm available all the time. And working international deals, I have to be available all the time. So it's hard to separate that, but it's important to do so. So on weekends, I try to leave my phone in another room and do my best to be there with my kids face-to-face and present, whatever they're wanting to do.
Tom, any book recommendations out there for any IT pros? And what are you reading right now?
So if you're looking to become a engineer or architect in pre-sales, or if you're looking to understand some of the things that a pre-sales engineer that you may work with, how they think, John Kerr is a great gentleman who does a lot of training for sales and getting ready for the architecture. And his book, The Trusted Advisor Sales Engineer, is actually very good for how to build that trust with customers, or how to recognize when someone's trying to build trust with you, and to kind of understand how the sales process goes in a general way. I would recommend anyone who's looking toward sales or thinks they're in ops or admin and want to go to sales to read that book and see if it's everything you think it will be, because there's a lot of great things about making transition, and there's a lot of things that leave you scratching your head. And as for what I'm reading right now, there's a book called Predictable Irrational. And it is a great book by an economist. As I said, I was an economics major, where they do... they talk about how irrational people are and how free means a lot, but you don't want a cheap solution. So if you are offered a 10-cent truffle or a free Hershey Kiss, you'll take the Hershey Kiss all the time, even though the 10-cent truffle may be a better deal for a piece of candy. But if you're looking at an aspirin, you'll take a 50-cent aspirin over a 1-penny aspirin, because the 1-penny aspirin definitely can't work as well. And that kind of stuff is just amazing and intriguing to me. So it's a great read, and it just leaves you laughing every time, just to see how people are easily manipulated through marketing and and how price matters, I guess.
Well, yeah, I was an economics minor in college, so I won't pretend any expertise. But the main reason I took it was for an experimental economics class. We'd run an experiment every single class. And I remember one that proved like how irrational I was in certain decisions, where it was presenting because the professor would actually pay out money if like depending on how you performed in games, which I always thought was really cool also. But one of them was like basically it was like, all right, you can win, you have a 1 in 4 chance. If you don't take the bet, basically you get $1. And the 1 in 4 is you get $2 or something like that. And then they kept increasing the payout, but the odds would remain relatively the same. And it was amazing to see how your perception of what was worth the risk changed, even though the odds would stay exactly the same. And it's kind of along those lines. It's always very interesting and revealing.
Yeah, I always had an interest in that. And there's a discipline called game theory that even really takes, you could see it even in every day, just if everybody cooperated, things would go better overall. But there's too much in it for you if somebody else doesn't cooperate, so you don't cooperate.
I did that. I remember reading an article. It was about traffic patterns and about how you should always let someone in and, you know, leave like the 3-car distance because that helps overall traffic or something like that. But it only works if everyone does it, traffic will flow beautifully. But if you don't, you just look like an idiot. And I just remember trying to force people to be like, no, everyone be nice, please. And game theory proved me a fool.
Yes, yeah, the prisoner's dilemma.
They were all
in a different
the
type of
to
prison.
Kill me. Yeah. all right, Tom. And first computer you ever owned?
The first computer I owned was a Hewlett Packard. It's like a 386. It was a long time ago. I don't even remember much about it. I didn't really get into computers or technology for a very long time. So the first computer I ever built was just a desktop. I ordered different parts off of Newegg and sourced it. And that's the first time I really consider an influential computer in my life. And it was a Pentium 1.
What was the, was there like a, did you want a game on it? Was there like a, some kind of, what were you envisioning when you built that computer, I guess?
Somebody handed me legally, I'm sure, a stack of 3.5-inch floppies with Doom 2 on it.
Nice.
And they were like, this is the best game you'll ever play. And so I built a computer, I figured out how to build a computer and built it to play Doom 2. And I never got past the second level because I really hate horror games. And at the time, that was the most realistic graphics in any video game I'd ever seen. And so I was terrified, and I've never played past the second level of Doom 2, but I created an entire pathway through my life because of it.
Thank you, dubiously legal copies of Doom 2.
Yeah, I didn't admit that in public or anything, right?
No, of course not.
Okay, cool.
All right, and Tom, what are you doing when you're not working in IT?
So I host the Fee Brownbag podcast on Wednesday nights. So that's one of the fun things I do. It's still IT related, but it's more just hanging out with a bunch of friends. And we talk about technology. We talk about certification, whatever people have brought up that they want to learn. Right now, we're going through a certification path for people who want to get AWS professional certifications.
Where can people find that?
It's vbrownbag.com is the main site. But if you go to vbrownbag.com/brownbags, you can see the upcoming shows and sign up. And then if you go to youtube.com/vbrownbag, you can see the archive of all the shows that we've done since 2014, I guess, is when it started. It's actually a really cool program. It was started because somebody... Cody Bunch is the name of the founder, and he couldn't find any resources to study for a VMware certification, so he created a podcast that's gone for a very long time, and we have presence at many of the big conferences doing tech talks.
Very cool stuff. And Tom, how do you caffeine if you do?
I caffeine a lot, and my utilitarian Keurig is just setting 20 steps away, so I go there a lot. That's typically how I caffeine, but I also like to get out of the house to work and see that people still exist and, you know, zombie apocalypse hasn't happened outside.
And so there's
a little coffee shop I go to called Coffee Times in Lexington, Kentucky. I would recommend anybody who's coming around to stop at. And they have a traditional macchiato that's one of the best I've had.
What is your go-to pod for the Keurig?
The Starbucks Holiday Blend. Every year around Thanksgiving, it comes out because of Christmas time, and it literally is like buying 10 cases at Sam's Club.
So when it gets around to like October, you're rationing it out at that point?
Yeah, well, that's the whenever you're feasting on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever you get sort of January after it's off the shelves, it's rationing it out to make sure I've got enough to sell. I celebrate special occasions with it. It's kind of sad, actually. I start using it. It's like, I had a good customer call today. It's time for a good cup of coffee.
However you can motivate yourself, that's what's important. Yeah. And then who would you like to see answer the IT Origins questions?
Cody Bunch. He's the founder of Vibram Bag, like I mentioned earlier. He's a big influence in my career. And he's just an all-around great guy. I would love to see him be on the show and talk about his origin.
Awesome. We will definitely have to reach out and see if that's possible. And we'll get you out on this, Tom. Best career advice you've received?
If you want to make any sort of change in your career, you have to work for it. So setting a goal of, you know, for me, whenever I went from being an engineer and operator to become a pre-sales, I was saying my goal is to get to that point, but really setting achievable goals with your ultimate destination being a career change is a lot better. So if you want to get somewhere, figure out how you get there. Don't set getting there as the goal. Set how you can make a change. How can you get sales experience if you're manning a keyboard? Or how can you get Google experience if all you do is work in Windows? And you just figure it out, set out a path that way. And you won't get as discouraged if your goal is to become, say, an architect. That's a great thing to put up on your vision board. But it's not as achievable as, say, go and make a design and present it to someone in the leadership of your current company. That's an easily achievable goal.
Tom, excellent advice. I think definitely good perspective. It kind of goes back, I'm not familiar with the comic Calvin and Hobbes, but there's a famous one where, Calvin wants to go to the moon or something like that, and Hobbes wishes for a sandwich. His wish comes true, Calvin's doesn't.
It doesn't mean you won't get to the moon, but the sandwich is a good first step, right?
You need to eat. So always important to keep in mind. Tom Green, thank you so much. This was a pleasure, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.